wouldn't come here to face me. I wouldn't collect call her to try to gauge how much hate she had left for me from only the sound of her voice. Visitors could be heard on the other side of the green wall. I knew they were visitors from the way they talked too loud, too fast, laughed when no one was laughing, tried too hard. They also spoke of outside things, alien experiences, like visits to movie theaters and concert halls and items of clothing they'd walked into a store and bought. Through the reinforced window, laced with scratches from girls left waiting for their visitors, I could see in. I saw Lola shove through into the visiting area. Mac, crying at the first sight of her family, who came every week and called her Mackenzie, was swift on Lola's heels. Even Kennedy had a visitor, a woman with shorn hair, so she must have known of Kennedy's habit and didn't want to come in, tempting her. I heard the shorn woman, Kennedy's mother, big sister, former parole officer, lover, pastor, aunt, ask after Kennedy's faint echo of a black eye, and I heard Kennedy use an excuse my mother once used, which was that she'd been in the shower and accidentally knocked a bar of soap into her own eye. I saw Lola at a nearby table with her own visitor release a small, smug smile. Then I spotted Ori. A teenage boy was at her table, slouching and with hair in his eyes. Her hand and his hand were under the table, clasped together, and stowed out of sight of the CO on duty nearby. So this was Miles. It made me want to shove a fist through the glass if that glass was even breakable. She hadn't mentioned a visit. She avoided talking to me about him, like she had to keep us in separate rooms. I wanted to get close enough to make him sit up straight and force his hair out of his eyes. I wanted to see how much he knew about her and whether it was as much as I now knew. But Blit was guarding the doorway. Though their hands touched in secret, and I can't know how tightly their fingers were laced, how sweaty their palms, their faces showed me so much. His was rigid and red with frustration. Hers was drawn, opaque as a swirling storm. He was trying to convince her of something. She was shaking her head no. I liked that. An adult hovered nearby, his parent or guardian, and held out a bag of potato chips from the vending machine. Ori reached out to take a chip, but the adult shifted the bag across the table to Miles. He grabbed a handful and gave them to Ori. She crunched. No one had ever shared anything from the vending machine with me in all my years here. This wasn't necessarily what love looked like, but it was close enough to cause the other girls at separate tables with their own visitors to turn and stare. After, I asked her what she and Miles were talking about. She shook off any surprise at how I found out, but wouldn't meet my eyes. I told him there isn't going to be any appeal, she said, and he should stop pushing me and pushing me. He should move on with his life. But, I started. In fact, I agreed with him. We were in our cell, the steel door open because it wasn't yet time to be locked in. It was here that the sound of an approaching CO quieted us. Santa Suso came into view. He was smiling, and I wished he weren't.
Amber, he called to me. Guess what? You've got a date on the books.
I approached the doorway, my feet bare and my shoes in the tub on the floor, my number on the wall above my head. Others from B-Wing leaned in, listening. I saw Mississippi. She had 93 days left to serve on her sentence and was doing crunches against the wall. The crunches stopped. I watched Jody, more than 200 days remaining, drop her hand of cards. They knew. Ori didn't know. I sensed her behind me, brimming with questions. Santa Suso told me the day of my coming release. It was in September, as had been promised. None of the other girls said a word.
Get ready, Santa Suso said, waving his arm at the tiered cell block, the barred doors, the green walls, the bolted-down tables, and rock-hard, immovable chairs. Soon, you'll be leaving all this. I couldn't imagine it. With Santa Suso gone, the others came up to say their piece. I was offered congratulations, mumbled bits of luck. I was told to write letters, though they knew I wouldn't. And I was asked if I'd pass along messages to ex-boyfriends and current boyfriends and old friends. I was told to eat a good meal at the closest White Castle and think of them. She didn't speak until they'd all left me be. "You're getting out?" Ori said. One of my shoulders made a shrug-like twitch. "Next week?" 10 days, I said. "Yeah, I guess that is next week." And how soon that seemed. 10 days. And only 10. 10 out of how many hundred that had come before. My stomach heaved, and I almost made a break for our shared toilet to throw my lunch up. "How long have you known?" she asked. "A while," I admitted. "I was going to tell you." "You deserve it," she said, and how wrong she was. "They're acting funny because they're jealous. Everyone knows you should never have been here." Wrong again. I looked down at her hideous feet. All dancers have them, she'd told me. I wondered what those feet used to look like when they were moving, whipping around in the air, her body making pretty shapes for an audience. It seemed so absurd, but something about Ori made me believe it. Now I'd never get to see. "You know, you'll do fine out there, Amber," she said, sensing my fear. "It'll be good, really. You'll get to go back to school and graduate and see your sister, who misses you so much. And you'll meet someone, I bet. Some guy. And you'll have to write me and tell me all about him." I wanted to say no. No to all of it. Especially to meeting someone, because why? Because who? "What about you?" I said instead. "What about me?" She sat with her legs crossed on the bottom bunk. All the surrounding gray brought out her eyes. "I'm basically never getting out," she said. "Not until I'm like 45. You know that." I did. At least, it was what the court had determined for her. Once her juvenile sentence was over, she'd be transferred to serve out the rest of her time with the most violent adult female offenders the state could serve up. That was what happened to us when our days at Aurora Hills were over and our time was longer than could fit in here. She would become an adult in prison, like I'd thought I would. She'd be nothing like the person she was now. In 30 years, I wouldn't even recognize her. I wasn't sure if she looked ahead at her life inside and wanted what I told myself I'd wanted, which was a place to call my own within these cold stone walls. All she knew. All she knew was that she was trying to help. Ori had returned the library cart to me, or so she thought, as my transfer from the kitchen still hadn't made it through all official channels. With my release date on the books, I wasn't sure it would in time. Nothing in Aurora Hills was ever so easy. Some efforts felt endless, and others turned around whip fast, so we kept looking over our shoulders, checking to be sure it was true. All actions here had consequences. It was only a matter of when. Ori started returning from afternoon yard duty with the plants she must have promised Peaches in exchange for my cart. Day after day, she managed to transport bits and pieces of the vines inside to hand over, and not one of the guards heard the rustling inside her jumpsuit when she walked past their stations or noticed the petals she'd sometimes shed on the stone floor, pinkened with pigment and gummy enough to stick. She'd meet Peaches, do the handover, and then Peaches would come swinging by, lingering at the doorways to our cells or in the hallway outside the wood shop. And those of us who wanted what she was selling would offer up items from our canteen accounts or make promises we wouldn't have the time to keep. There were many ways to come up with payment. Some of us were seeking escape, even more so after the night the locks malfunctioned and let us loose, and then took it all back and said, never mind. But I didn't want to be numbed up with any drug, the way Peaches and her crew wanted us all to be, the way Damore used to long for, probably still does. I wanted my mind clear. I thought it was. But the memory was there. It was hanging around the corner, waiting. I saw the haze that enveloped so many of the girls around me, and a certain saccharine scent that lingered after one of us had succumbed. The drug made us forget. I wondered what would happen if one of us took too much. Would we remember? And remember what? Peaches accepted what was owed, but that didn't keep her from holding it against one person, and that person was me. It was midweek, a handful of days away from my release, when she shoved into the cafeteria line in front of me and grabbed the top tray and the closest cup, which was the red cup. She took her time in the line for slop, chatting, sucking her bottom lip, stretching out her back and scratching a roaming itch. I couldn't push, and I couldn't tell her to keep moving. These were rules so well known among us that they didn't need to be written. Power was taken here, and once it was solidly in hand, those of us who didn't make a grab for it, or who did and missed, were bowled over, mown down. She may as well have been standing on my prone body, a foot jammed in the back of my neck, her arms raised in a victory V. I stood in line behind her and waited for her to move on. "What?" Peaches said to me, about facing to shove her jaw in my direction. "Nothing," I said under my breath. There was no other response to make in this situation. If I said another word now, anything at all, even something silly to make a joke of it, I'd risk losing one or more of my front teeth. I'd been here for years and still had all my original teeth. I was hoping to keep them. "No what?" Peaches said. "What were you going to say, what?" "Did she say something?" Jody joined in, many heads taller than both of us and casting us in shadow. "What'd she say?"
"I didn't." They stared me down. "I didn't say anything."
I'd gone around their backs. That was what Peaches and Jody were communicating to me. I had my precious book cart, didn't I? So was I happy now? How happy? Because if I was too happy, they'd go ahead and make me miserable, as only the happiest among us deserved to be. I left my unfilled tray like I wasn't even hungry, and headed for the table, where I usually sat with girls from B-Wing. When I approached, it emptied, leaving only my cellmate, Ori, who looked to me in question. She tried to share her food, but I shook her off. It was coming. Retaliation. More and more of them had turned against me. I was used to them letting me be, ignoring me so I could sidle in and listen to what they said, catalog, mull over, keep for later. But a line had been drawn, and Peaches and Jody were on one side of it. I found myself on the other. I was in the library during free time, sorting the books, dusting their spines and jackets, wiping clean their glossy faces, and straightening their bent corners. It wasn't officially my life skills job anymore, but I couldn't help wanting to keep things nice. The stomping sound of their approach startled me. I set down a stack of books.
"Hey there," Jody said. Peaches grinned.
I knew then to cover my head. It was Jody who delivered the first blow. She didn't use her fists. She had her fingers gripped in a white sock, and weighted down in the hanging toe of the sock was something heavy. It could have been a bar of soap, a hunk of brick. It could have been the smallest book on our shelves, one of the pocket classics. All I knew was that it hurt on impact and gave a good pounding. Peaches came next, and the socks in her hands were two. I curled into the smallest shape I could make myself, which wasn't so small. Tucked my head in, wanting to keep my teeth. There was the feeling of everything and the feeling of nothing, which I guess comes when the pain is too much and you pass out. Maybe that was when I decided to do something, hovering in that state halfway between waking to consciousness and being blacked out. Because even then, even after this, I knew where I belonged in the sea of all the Earth's strangers. Where we all belonged. What justice might look like if I were the one to wield it inside these walls, where no one used to look at me or pay me much attention, but now for sure they would. How inevitable it felt, how perfectly timed and carved out to fit the pieces together without any gaps between. It was as if I had the key to every last lock. I stood, wavering. I gathered up the rest of the breaths sifting around in my lungs and made a rhythm of them. I braced myself against a bookshelf. And then I let go. I stopped in our cell in B-Wing on the way, and maybe I knew what I was doing and where I was going because I'd done it before, and maybe I knew nothing. We all wished we could plead not guilty. I made it somehow to the kitchen. It was a Thursday afternoon, or a Tuesday, but surely afternoon, and I was due for my life skills assignment in the kitchen. I found myself in the back near the burners, as I knew I would. I found myself stirring the peas. The pot of peas. The peas were supposed to be green, but they looked more gray. The swirl of gray-green in the pot. The spoon gripped in my hand. The spoon making circles. The circles of the spoon. Maybe that was what got my memory circling, then clearing and starting to show something visible there, down at the bottom, crusted like the burned base of the pot and not coming loose from the spoon. Something I forgot. Something I'd been trying to remember all this time. The pot itself was enormous, large enough to cook a human stew. The spoon was as long as a hunting spear. My arm ached, and parts of my face pulsed, and one of my eyes wouldn't open all the way. Somehow, nobody in the kitchen noticed. They saw what they wanted to see. Outside, in the world beyond Aurora Hills, I'd heard it's even worse. The noise and activity of the kitchen roared all around me. There was Kennedy, doing dishes, her hands too deep in the suds to yank off some of her hair for eating. I still didn't know her crime, but I felt for sure she must have been guilty. There was Damore. Had she gotten out of the infirmary and assigned a new cellie? Or did she have special permission to return her own meal trays? She sloped past, a loose bandage trailing the floor. No question she was guilty. Natty dumped a tray of cups in the vat, nodded, moved on. One of the cups was the red one. The one I still hadn't found on my tray, though I looked for it every day. It floated to the top, shifting the others aside. Natty was guilty. A group of girls could be heard passing in the corridor. Every last one of them was guilty. Out the window in the kitchen, I could see the barred windows of D-Wing, filled with suicides and anyone on restriction. Guilty. And myself? Guilty then. And still guilty, today. I stirred the peas, gazing into the pot. There was nothing to see, at first. Only the green peas and the gray. Then there was more and more gray. A different kind of gray. Gray like the stones that stacked to make our walls were solid and gray. Gray like white paint after so many years of being allowed to stay dirty. Gray like a girl's heart when she's been forced to reckon with what she's done and no one believes she really is guilty. That kind of gray. Then I realized why. It was how my head was turned toward the ceiling, how I was looking up instead of looking down at all of us. There was something below me, something wanting my attention. My eyes drifted and flickered, seeking focus. One wouldn't stay open, but the other saw fine. My nose took a whiff of the abominable smell. When I turned my neck, slowly, the tendons creaking as if I hadn't used this part of my body in years, I could see the feet first. Our feet, our canvas slip-on shoes, they were white, but white never stayed white for long in this place, so really they were gray. Some of them were splayed on the tiled floor. Some had been lost in the shuffle, and some were there, wedged on. The feet of so many girls I recognized, from C-wing and A-wing and B-wing, all dropped to the floor as if we were playing a game. And that game was pretending to be dead. Where was I among them? I sifted through the crowd, looking down on all of them, far enough away to not get the mess on me, but not far enough to escape the stench. It was rotten, and it was also sickly sweet. It was terrible, rising up to choke all my senses. These girls weren't playing. This was the cafeteria, where we gathered 3 times a day to eat our meals, those of us who weren't on lockdown in solitary. There were the tables and the trays, but there was none of the usual din. There was no noise. I could see little T in a seat at the end of the table. She was slumped over the side of her stool, head to her knees so her face was hidden. Her arms were slack and hanging, but her fingers were still clasped tight around the handle of a plastic spoon. Peaches had fallen, face first, onto the green floor. Her hair flung up over her head to reveal the tattoo on the back of her neck that she'd always kept hidden. It was a braided series of flowers, feathery and delicate, really quite beautiful. The spittle coming from her mouth was green, too, and all that green brought to mind the forest that surrounded our compound, the climbing vines from the garden and grounds where Ori worked, the drugs so many of us ingested that summer, giving us green-hued dreams and green, crusty eyes in the morning, all the green in this gray place that hid us from the law-abiding world. We were a part of this place even more now. We were as essential to its continuing existence as the moss and the grass and the trees. There was Sherry. She'd fallen backward off her stool, and in the drop, which must have been sudden, and which landed her on another sharp-edged stool behind her, she'd broken open her skull. So the green goo spewed from her mouth, but pooling around her neck, coming out of her ears, was red. And green and red make brown. All this I took in without emotion, as if petty things such as feelings had been carved out of me the way melons get scooped of their seeds. If only I could remember where I was sitting and eating dinner that day, I'd be able to find where I fell. I drifted over the aisles, plugging up my nose as I went. The fallen trays scattered the little things everywhere. And they were round, so they rolled. Some had been mashed into paste, but many were still intact and kept rolling across the tile, all the way to the outer ends of the room and back again, like more than my memory was sloshing. Once green, but gray because they came out of cans. Peas. But mixed with what? With the mashed-up pulp of that plant we'd never found a name for because it wasn't in any of our books? Shouldn't that just give us hallucinations, like before? Trips to the sky and back and faint heart murmurs, fits of giggles? Did anyone know it could do so much more if too much of the stuff was mashed in? Didn't anyone notice how sweet the peas tasted that day? How sugary and almost delicious, like gumdrops mixed with dirt? And then I remembered who'd been at the pot, stirring. I remembered my own arm, my own hand. Shouldn't I have known there was something wrong with the peas? Or had I known all along? Someone was approaching and joined me by the trash pails. The scorch marks on her face hadn't fully faded, so she hovered there, lavender in hue. "You've gone and done it now," Damore said, though without surprise, like she'd known all along this was coming. "Now we can't ever leave." We couldn't ever leave. I hadn't been able to face that Damore was seeing our future before, but she must have seen this. So had I. I'd just forgotten. The doors were open now, the locks were undone, and we couldn't go. I looked around once more. I was mistaken about the gray because when I blinked, it was gone. Where there had been gray walls, there were green-growing vines, and where there had been partitions and cordoned off sections to keep inmates from roaming too far out of sight of the COs, there were open, shaggy spaces of field. There were gaps in the fence that would let a whole herd of us escape into the forest. There were graffiti tags on what was left of the cinder block walls, showing all the strangers who had snuck in here. This place had come falling down, and all that was left was us now. We girls, poisoned to death during dinner by one of our own, we'd be here longer than these walls would be left standing. "Who did this?" I was asking Damore. "Did you do this?" "Did I?" She shook her head. She was caught up in it, staring as if we were fresh off the blue-painted bus, here to observe one of the great wonders of the world. "I shouldn't be here. I'd been released. In days, I was supposed to be taken out front and let go. I was going to be issued street clothes. They'd have to give me real shoes, and I'd walk out onto the sidewalk in those shoes. They were going to let me out in the care of my mother. I was supposed to see September. They might as well have backed me up against the rear of the building and had me shot in the head by a firing squad. The last time I was out there in the world, I was 13. The last time I saw my mother, she'd turned her back on me like I was the bullet. I didn't want to go. I didn't want any of us to go, ever. Was that why I'd done it? That was when I saw the body by the far table. It wasn't my own. The two long legs were clad in orange. One of the feet had lost a shoe and the foot was bare and blistered with a bulbous purple calloused toe. Hadn't I told her never to eat the peas? Wasn't that advice I'd given her very first day? Damore wouldn't say it, and the others about to be awakened and risen to join us, none of them would say it. And my one good eye started tearing up, so neither eye could see the cafeteria without blurs. Only one of us didn't deserve to be here, not even for a night. Oriana Spearling was the only one who was truly innocent. It was all too much for me. My mistake. Facing my fate, which was all of our fates entwined as one, even hers. Seeing it plain. Seeing myself even if I didn't yet find my body. I was back at the pot again, stirring what would be our poison, and I couldn't make myself stop. Because it had already happened. Because it is happening now as I stand here. I'm watching myself stir the peas as we speak. And my skin goes electric. My entire body does. The kitchen from end to end lights up with the blaze of blue light that fried Damore, boiling my memory, getting time confused, and my brain blackens into a wall without windows, and my body drops like one last bag of useless meat to the floor. This is what happens when I let myself remember what I did. It happens every time. We'll forever be. We'll forever be pointing fingers, playing detective, to see who might be caught red-handed, overheard and telling a bald-faced lie. Peaches says it has to be Kennedy. Peaches found a hair on her tray, she says, a curly Kennedy-colored hair in her peas. Half of us want to point the finger at Kennedy, and if we had keys to our jail cells, we'd have locked her in solitary long ago and shaved off all her hair. A couple of us say it was Anne-Marie, though with her kept in D-Wing, it's impossible to say how she would have done it. Lots of us say it was Peaches, and many more say Damore. None of us think it was Ori. If she helped someone else get to the vines, if she smuggled them inside one afternoon after her work in the garden, it was only for my benefit. She had no idea what anyone would do. None of us knows for sure it has always been me. Here we are pointing fingers and devolving into arguments, and those arguments can last all night, now that we have eternity. Because when we think of it that way, what's a night or two? We don't know what they say about us on the outside. They don't deliver newspapers up here. We were the juvenile delinquents of Aurora Hills, and while a good number of us were sent up for some of the worst crimes anyone could imagine, More often, the crimes that sealed our fates started off teaspoon size. The virgin infractions for a few of us were laughable. Writing our name on an already written-on wall. Jumping a train turnstile. Pocketing a tube of lipstick. We were infamous only after. Before, our names were drawn in crayon by Sunday school children onto construction paper angels left on the fence down at the bottom of the hill. These were names not many people would remember. The scene when the ambulances climbed the hill and the gates opened and the police found us was one that couldn't be hidden from the public. Word of a tragedy travels. People delight in demise. So it was chaos in the cafeteria. And that was after we were all dead. Officials were brought in to make a count of all of us, just as we were used to being counted multiple times a day. The bodies were numbered at 41, including those who'd been served their dinner in the solitary cells on D-Wing, and the ones still bedded in the infirmary. 41. Which could not be. Aurora Hills corrections officers said, as there were no escapees left unaccounted for, every girl locked in her rightful place, and so the count should be 42. Those counting went back to the head of the line of bodies, clipboards at the ready. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Enough of us to build a small army, had we still been fight-worthy. Enough of us to make a true mark on the world, good or bad, had we lived. 10, 20, 30, 37, 38, 39, 40, 41. They'd counted. Then they had to count again. As they neared the end of one more count, there was a pause. Had they lost a girl in the shuffle? Had one been released to the morgue without the right people being notified? Who is to answer for this? Will we have to try doing the count over again? Oh, sorry. They must have miscounted before, because suddenly the outcome was right. They reached the final body, and it was as expected, 42. There was so much activity after we died that we must have made it worse with all our confusion. Some of us were still clinging to our throats, wanting to spit the bad bits out. Others of us drifted. We didn't need our legs to walk, but we needed some sense of direction to propel us through the crowd, and it was a challenge to get control at first. We headed for the kitchen, but none of us could find the obvious culprit. There was a frenzy around the spilled plates and cooking pots, causing a haze that made the living humans, those in uniform trying to perform the forensic investigation, start gagging, even with their protective masks on, and have to leave the room. Immediately after death, emotions are so raw. We were powder white and livid, but it was too late to stop what had already happened. The bodies we left under the sheets out in the cafeteria had choked and turned green. The frenzy of discovery lasted a long time, and when we'd finally calmed, there was no one else left in the kitchen with us. The living had gone. They'd left, and they'd carted out our bodies with them. There was no one guarding our doors. There was no one working our gates. There was quiet. Outside these walls, time marched forward without us. We died early one evening in late August, but the world didn't stay put in that humid state. We were so preoccupied howling and crying and being wounded and wronged and upset, I guess it took us a while to see it. A rainstorm broke through and then dried up. The wind swept up the hill and the air chilled. The leaves fell and the snow covered them. The ice decorated our windows and then melted clean away. The tree in our rec field bloomed in pale flowers, and the ivy that climbed our gray stone walls flowered in bright colors and grew thorns. The heat came, and by the next August, the world outside our walls had grown wilder. But beyond that, it hadn't much changed. The only difference out there, if we took it down to the nitpicky details we could see through our chicken-wired windows, was that no one from groundskeeping had kept up with the gardening or the mowing of the lawns. As time moved forward and the seasons changed, the Aurora Hills Secure Juvenile Detention Center in the far northern reaches of our already northern state was closed. No new girls came in, and there were no newly freed girls to be let out. The second August came around. A third August came, and a third August went. Now it's another August, marking the day we overdosed on the poison plant mixed in with our green peas, and we can no longer tell just which August we're living in. We forget what day it is. We forget there's a reason we wanted to skip dinner. We forget what's coming, and that it's already come, again and again. The outside world hasn't forgotten us entirely, but the people don't think of us often anymore. We are names above a rotting mound of teddy bears on an iron gate. We are hated, and occasionally, by those who can see it in their hearts to forgive, we are mourned. We are proclaimed by believers who, if only they'd spent time with us before our end, think we could have been saved. Saved from what? From living these weeks over and over? We guess. From forgetting, and then remembering, so much worse each time because we tried so very hard the last time not to forget. We have some ideas about the afterlife, about why we are still here. The thing about a life being cut short when it's not by choice and not with any rhyme or reason or hinted at by diagnosis or threat is that sometimes some of you will want to hang on. We do. We can't seem to find a way to leave. When she returns. When she returns, we gather by the window slits, charting her progress through our yard behind the facility. We move from window to window, from wall to wall, watching as she weaves through our fence lines, as she wanders our grounds in the shadow of our barbed wire, without seeming to sense any of us eyeing her from above. The intruder never once looks up at our barred windows, though we will her to do so. A few of us shout down at her, but all she seems to hear is the wind. Some of us get shaken at the sight of her. So clearly is she from another world. We critique her clothes, make fun of her tightly slicked hair, her shiny barrettes. We brag about what we'll do to humble her if she comes up here and gets close. But there's a sadness beneath our mocking. A shred of jealousy. We won't say it, but we know she's still alive. Everything about the way she walks and holds herself tells us she is free. Has anyone seen her before? Some of us ask the others. Who is she anyway, and where'd she come from? None of us offer up any answers, especially me. I'm waiting for Ori to come to the window and recognize her. Then I'll help explain. Ori rushes then into B-Wing, and by her face I know she's seen Violet, the girl who's come again to haunt us, the ghost from her past who now all of us can see. Dirt covers Ori's arms and crusts her knees. She must have been working out in the garden again. She's come running inside to find me as if there's something I can do. She's back, she says, panic rising in her eyes. I don't know why she's here. She's not sorry. The question is, why? I'm beginning to sense the answer rising. I've turned from the others, so I don't realize at first where they're going or what they have in mind, though I should have. They get down there faster than I expect. The gathering noise outside tells me. Ori, though, isn't moving. I don't want to see her ever again, she says, and a prickle of electricity inside me says she won't have to. We've got other plans. Ori has no idea what we're about to do. She doesn't go down to watch, but I can't help it. There they are. There we are, outside in the rec area behind the facility. I emerge from the back door and find myself drawn closer. We're all hanging back, watching. The intruder is no longer on her own. A boy has joined her. I recognize Miles straight away, and I'm delighted to see what might happen with the two of them facing off. But I know this is not something most of the rest of us will understand. They don't know who he is, who they both are,
how they got in here, why the boy is so angry at the girl, why the girl might seem so familiar, why she becomes as bright as a beacon and the boy turns faceless and forgettable, and they don't much care about him. Still, we step closer. The light in the sky flickers. We feel it in our bones. That's all we are now. Bones. We sense that something is about to happen, and more, that we will be the ones to make it happen. We hope Ori is watching from the windows, because this is for her. Jody steps up. Natty gets a distinct smile on her face as she cracks her knuckles. But it's little Anne-Marie, emerged from D-Wing as if she traveled like vapor through the flimsiest of our walls, who is quick-thinking and so resourceful. She's got a shovel in hand, and she whips it fast. Barrettes go flying. For a lovely moment, the intruder seems to coast through the air, dancing for us. And some of us have never seen that kind of dancing, but then she drops into the dirt with a hard thump. A leg goes crooked. A foot bends funny. Her mouth opens, and red drips out. She's stopped moving, even when Jody gives her a kick. A piece of jewelry has fallen, and before anyone can say the word, we know it's too shiny to stay here. It may be gold, but among us it's worth nothing. Polly, who has the best pitching arm, throws it over our heads to get rid of it. We don't know where it lands, except that it's far away. We've forgotten about the boy entirely. We can't even see a trace of him anymore. Our hunger is for the guilty one, the girl. Only the guilty can truly see us, just as our shadowed eyes want to focus in on the guilty right back. We recognize the light she carries, blinking, beckoning, telling us what she's done. Like a long-lost sister will recognize you as family after years apart because you share the same nose. The body rolls into the hole and makes so much noise. To look at the body, so compact, with the long legs and the long arms, we assume she would have weighed a few ounces, her bones made of cotton puffs and air. But it's like a box of dishes pitched off the side. She makes such a clatter, and we've always heard ballerinas were full of grace. This girl down in the hole is the brightest light I've ever seen. She belongs with us. I climb down into the ditch. Mississippi puts out an arm to help me. I place the fallen girl's head in my lap and stroke her hair, now that it's lost its pins and decorations. The back of her skull has a giant gash from the shovel, and I cover the soft, gooey spot with my hand. She is showing up so clear that I can feel the strands now come loose from her bun. We are both hurting. It's the first time that I let myself feel that I am. My hands move along to trace the planes of her face. My hands are red from her, and on her face I get some smears. I am getting to know her the way I've gotten to know Oriana Spearling before her and Damore Wyatt before that. The others drift away. They're letting me have her. She comes too, but only to convulse, choking on what's left of her breath. It won't be long. There can't be much air remaining in her lungs now, and the seeping gash in the back of her head will end it all soon, since she's losing so much blood. Ori, she sputters, the very last living word she lets out. She still thinks I'm her friend. I'm not her friend. I never will be. But I guess now we're family. No, I say, not Ori. But you'll meet me soon enough. We hear the sirens in the far-off distance, like they've come calling for someone else. It's only as the sirens get closer that we realize, yes, this is happening again. This is our last day again, and this sound belongs to us. Again. The swarm of people in the cafeteria makes it hard to keep track of one another. We call out over the din, but what we're doing is creating the din, howling and crying and bleeding our panic the way we always do. Each time we reach this day, we go through it at this heightened state. And then we forget. We want to forget. We forget that too. We forget it's what we wanted.
We are lined up for count again. That's eternal. The warden has a long list of all our names.
I'm on it. And checked off quickly.
Ori is on it. But she's not so easily found. I don't know where she is.
We hear them counting. We watch from the ceiling, look down from above. They have reached 30.
They have reached 31, 32, 33. They have reached 40 now. And how long does it take to walk down a row and count all of our bodies? We're so impatient. They have reached 41.
Here they pause. They don't see her yet, but I do. I know it's her by the funny bend in her foot. They can't hear me point her out. They're not so attuned.
42. She is right there. Just look.
42.
Finally, a head swivels. One of the COs. But they've all gone as gray and blurry as distant spirits, and I can't tell which one. There. They see her. A small crowd gathers. She's not wearing a jumpsuit like the others are. She's covered in dirt, as if she'd been buried and dug out of the ground to join us here.
It makes sense they're so confused.
Which one is this? One of the COs says. The other rattles off names from his list of different inmates. There are a lot of us, but none of the names he gives belongs to the girl on the ground. They haven't noticed her twisted leg, the way it bends backward at an angle that defies medical science. They haven't turned her over to view the gash in her head. All we know is she is now one of us. We lost one of our number, and no one noticed. But how quickly our number has been restored. It seems we are meant to stay at full capacity, which for this facility is 42 girls.
They use the blue-painted bus to cart all the bodies away. It takes 3 trips.
We watch the front landing area from our window slits, crowded around the openings as we used to on the days new inmates were due to arrive. We watch them take us out in body bags. And from this distance, we can't tell whose body is whose inside the opaque plastic. We can only guess at what belongs to us, whose hanging arm or whose dangling foot, whose hair is caught in the zipper. Our bodies are piled in the back. There we are, so still, so docile. We no longer need chains. The doors are closed on us, and the bus leaves the curb for the last time and heads for the gate. Violet Dumont, cold-blooded murderer of 2 15-year-old girls, traitor and unrepentant liar, never caught, never sentenced, never jailed. Not until she visited us, and we made it right. Is new among us, and not yet sure of our ways or our rules. She refuses to look out the window with the rest of us. She's having a hard time settling in, which so many of us can relate to. We wonder how she'll break on her first night, and we offer up a few suggestions and catcalls and bets to pass the time. I abstain, as she now has top bunk in our shared cell, and I don't want my eyes clawed out while I'm sleeping. We figure she might rave and kick and fight the first night the locks slam closed, but she'll get used to it, in time. She'll have to. Now she's finally being punished for what she did. All we can tell her of eternity is what we have right here. If we'd known. If we'd known, we might not have been so angry, so fused solid with rage, so willing to kick a girl when she was down and walk away. This is night, and we've finally located the one we called Ori. The late August heat hovers over her as she descends the hill and gets on her knees to crawl through the hole in the fence. If she could see a mirror in the night, a mirror better than the tinfoil hung for vanity in our cells, she would be struck by the changes. When she was sent upstate after sentencing, she had round cheeks and dark, endlessly long hair. The detention center made her cut her hair, and the stress and shock and fear of being accused and then found guilty for a crime she did not commit took away the apples in her cheeks and most of the shine from her eyes. If she saw who she would turn into, outside our walls, upon exiting the hole in our fence, she would have been startled. 3 years have passed on the outside. Outside our walls, she is 18. We watch her down there now. We see how she's just emerged through the hole in the fence. There is a hand, a boy's hand, and it's reaching out to help her up. The night sounds keep in time with her breathing, a bleating of insects, a rustling in the woods, but no birds beyond a lone owl. If she looks up, she could have seen stars. Look up, we want to tell her. For us. Look up. Hey, the boy says. You okay? Miles is just as she remembered him, but more wild-eyed, maybe. Longer hair, scruffy chin beard and stubble. He seems dazed, but he's only out of breath from running down the hill. Did he see what she saw? We can't know, but we can assure her it's him, absolutely and inexplicably, him. Though she doesn't need us to tell her. She would know for sure it is really Miles when she took his hand and felt his palm, which would be warm and dry and strong in grip, as strong as she remembered. She could trace his lines. She could reach up and map his face, draw the whorls in his ears, stick her fingers inside, though he used to hate when she did that, and he'd squirm and say, stop. She could lean in close and breathe in the particular smell of his neck, which would be just as she remembered, as he still used the same soap. She could put her mouth to his and make like she was going to kiss him, only she'd suck his bottom lip, taking it inside her mouth like she wouldn't let go and holding it there, a piece of him. She hasn't been able to do so many things to him in so long. But she hasn't been let out for a boy. She knows that, as we do. There is a whole life out there waiting for her. Even the shoes fit. Miles tries to help her stand up, but it's all too much for her. Too much. For a moment, she has no breath in her lungs. Her knees bend back down to the ground, and her legs, still muscled, still strong, have turned to jelly. She's in the grass on the damp ground outside the fence, and the ground here is littered with stuffed bears and headless dolls and doll heads and candles burned down to the nub so no match could ever hope to light them. There are ragged, crumpled pieces of colored paper that give best wishes to the dead for an eternity in heaven, or in hell, though what exists beyond this iron gate is neither. Miles crouches down at her side. Come on, they want to get going. He points to a green sports car she's never seen before in her life. He's still trying to pull her up. You said goodbye like you wanted, but we've got to drive back. Juilliard is waiting. I thought you said you had to pack. Remember. We are pushing her to remember. In increments, particle by particle and piece by piece, she begins to recall it. Then, as she stands back up again, she sees it. The glint, like a spark in the darkest patch of night. She bends down to pick up the delicate gold strand from where it must have fallen. She recognizes it right away as violets. Miniature sculpted ballerinas hang from the strand, tinkling. How tiny their toes are. How spindle-thin their raised arms, too minuscule to contain fingers. But there is a knot in the chain she can't get out. A clump of dried mud or fungus or something in the clasp. It's blood, but she doesn't catch that. The bracelet fits around her wrist as if it had been made for her. Violet had never let her even try the bracelet on before, since it was expensive, she said, and all those charms were special, bought for her by her dad, and her parents wouldn't like it. Let's go, says Miles. Someone is leaning out the open window of the green car, someone she recognizes vaguely from a long time before. Violet used to be cruel and call this girl Rooster. We waited forever, the girl says. We were so worried we were going to call the police. and another boy in the driver's seat is waving her over impatiently now. He's hungry, he says. He wants to stop and get something to eat. And Miles again. Miles. It's over now, he says low, near her ear. And he's pulling her by her arm, and he has her wait, and she lets him help her. And then she doesn't need his help, and she wants to walk on her own 2 feet, and she lets go. And she is lighter than air, and she walks on air to the car. And does he not know where she's been? And does anyone know where she's been, and for how long? She has no idea we're still watching. She's split off, become separate from us. So she doesn't feel our gaze hovering over her as she takes one last look at our iron gate and then goes back to prop up a few teddy bears that have fallen and to take a peek at the cards and signs that say our names, looking for her own name. She'll never find it, because when she exited the gate, her name was sponged off in an instant and replaced with another. We will always be an even 42. She gets in the car. She wears her seatbelt as she believes in safety first. Tommy starts the engine, and Sarah Beth gives her a hug. Miles holds on, firm, to her hand. Once inside the car, she does not look back again. She got her justice, thanks to us. And thanks to her, we will always be watching the road to see who might climb the hill and take the place of one of us, to see who might claim our guilt so we could be innocent too. For us, it is perpetually August. We come awake in our cells sweating. We wear our green sleeping clothes because it's night, and our green jumpsuits are hung up for tomorrow on our hooks. We hear the rain and the wind. We don't hear the locks coming open, for reasons we don't think we'll ever know, but we do hear Lola scream. We hear Jody ram her thick skull against the door, and we hear the door come open, and her roar of delight as she shares the news. We step out of our cages. We are free, like we sense we've been before. We're alive, or are we? At least we know she is. We lose sight of her when the car makes the turn. We can see the green sports car with the stripes for as long as it keeps straight on our road. But when the car heads for the highway, that takes her out of our line of sight. We can't follow now. Our world stops where the gate stops. Our feet can't run that road. We wish we could see her down in the city some of us had been born in, and some of us had committed our crimes in, and some of us had never gotten to visit, and wished we could have at least climbed the Statue of Liberty once before. Violet will tell us all about it, in time. She got so close. But Violet's not the one anymore. It's Ori we're wishing we could see. She'll be wearing black for us. That's how we picture it when she steps out on stage and stuns the crowd. She will be everything we couldn't be and more. In our heads, we will give her a standing ovation. From down the hill and down the state and hours away, hours and years and memories, we hope she can hear us. Our applause. How proud of her. How thrilled for her. How envious we'll be. We'll clap our hands for her. We'll stand in our seats. We'll shout. We'll wolf whistle. We'll scream. We'll make thunder for her. We'll make thunder for ourselves. In the sky above the ruins of what was once the Aurora Hills Secure Juvenile Detention Center, there will be a flash of lightning, a clap of thunder, and then we'll be washed in rain.
The End. We hope you have enjoyed this production of The Walls Around Us by Nova Ren Suma, narrated by Georgia King as Violet and Sandy Rustin as Amber. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.